You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, George, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us? I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero and the host of this Non-Zero World, the Friday edition of the Non-Zero podcast. You are George Beebe, the director of grand strategy at the Quincy Institute and a former head of Russia analysis at the CIA. So you are a perfect guest for our topic for today, which is previewing and talking about the meeting that will be happening today in Alaska between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, since this is probably going to post either right before the meeting or probably around the time after or when we're starting to see some results out of it, I'll try to keep the conversation to topics that will be of interest regardless of what happens there today. But maybe as a useful table setter, could you talk a little bit about, from your point of view, what the best reasonable outcome from today's meetings would look like?
Well, I think the best outcome for this meeting is one that doesn't try to do too much. It doesn't try to put in place an immediate unconditional ceasefire, for example. It doesn't try to wrap up all of the many issues that have to be negotiated to bring the conflict in Ukraine to an end. And it doesn't get out ahead of things in the U.S. bilateral relationship with Russia by trying to undertake very ambitious projects or cooperation that can't be sustained unless and until that war in Ukraine is settled. So what can be accomplished? What I hope would come out of this meeting? I hope the two presidents advance a framework agreement that lays out some fundamental compromises by all of the sides that will be necessary to end the war in Ukraine, and lays out a roadmap for future negotiations, some of which are going to have to be between Russia and Ukraine bilaterally, some of which will have to be between the United States and Russia bilaterally. Some will be multilateral, involving the U.S., Russia, and various European players. So this is a multidimensional conflict. It is a conflict over bilateral issues between Ukraine and Russia, a conflict over where the border between those countries is going to be drawn, a conflict over the treatment of ethnic, linguistic, and religious minorities. Also, it is a broader geopolitical conflict between Russia and the West over the shape of Europe's security architecture, over Russia's role in that architecture and Ukraine's role in that architecture. Those are big, complicated issues that are going to take a while to lay out. But I think the two presidents in Alaska can put together a framework that codifies a fundamental compromise. And I think that compromise ought to be that the United States says, we're not going to bring Ukraine into NATO, or we're not going to put NATO military forces on the ground on Ukrainian territory. And the Russians will have to reciprocate with a concession of their own. And I think the big one there is that they will accept that Ukraine can apply for membership in the European Union, and Russia won't attempt to block that. And that, I think, if the two presidents can codify that and then lay out a roadmap for all the other negotiations that have to take place to bring this deal across the finish line, I think that will be a major accomplishment.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious with the European Union question. I know that Europe, technically speaking, does have sort of a collective defense, if not obligation, some sort of mechanism for the European Union. Do you see that as a potential sort of blocking point for Russia in making such a concession?
Well, probably, but it's not an insurmountable obstacle. The Russians are certainly going to be wary about a relationship between the EU and Ukraine that is a military relationship. I think they'll be fine with political and economic integration, but I don't think they want to, on the one hand, solve their NATO problem, so to speak, only to see it replaced with an EU problem. So what I do think is likely is in the course of approving accession, that Russia stipulate that it does not want to see Ukraine integrated into any of the collective defense mechanisms or military security activities that the EU is involved in. And there are precedents for that. The Irish, for example, are members of the EU, but they don't participate in any military security issues. I think the Austrians are the same way. I think the Russians will say, you know, that's what we're hoping for with Ukraine as well. That is something we'll have to see.
Right. Right. And so what would be a next step after a framework agreement? Would you be hoping to see, you know, Trump is saying that perhaps it could even be that they get Zelensky on the next plane to Anchorage if all goes well. Is that sort of the best hope for these conversations?
Well, yeah, I think so. My guess is that President Trump has made a very wise choice in saying that bringing the three presidents together simultaneously would be fraught with risk. This could blow up. So what I think he wants to do is nail down some fundamental compromises from the Russians, showing that they are indeed willing to engage seriously in a peace process, even if they're not willing to announce an unconditional ceasefire up front. And then bring the Ukrainians in sequentially rather than simultaneously and say, look, here is the deal that we think can lead toward peace, and seek Ukrainian support for that. And I think there are probably pretty good prospects for getting the Ukrainians on board, particularly if some core Ukrainian interests are respected in a framework deal. Now, what are those? I think one is preserving that right to join the EU. I mean, that is, I think, above all, critical for Ukraine's future. It holds out the prospect that the country can be reconstructed. It can look forward to a future of some kind of economic prosperity, and it has some hope of attracting back to Ukraine the many millions of refugees that fled that war. Many of them went to Europe. That, I think, would be a core achievement for the Ukrainians. Now, the other things they're looking for is they want their right to legitimate self-defense preserved in this deal. They want to make sure that they have the right to get aid, military and security aid, intelligence aid from the West, from Europe, from the United States, in the event that some new conflict, new invasion breaks out. And they want Russia to agree to terms for a ceasefire that are monitorable, that are durable, reasonable from Ukraine's point of view. Now, the question of territory, I think, territorial adjustments is going to be a very difficult one. I frankly don't expect that that is going to be addressed in Alaska today. I think this is an issue that's going to be quite politically fraught for both Ukraine and Russia. And what I would expect is that this is going to be the subject of a negotiation that will take probably a fair amount of time to unfold. For now, I think the core principle that needs to be affirmed is that once a ceasefire is in place, that ceasefire will take the existing line of contact as the point of separation between Russia and Ukraine. And then any kind of adjustments to the map, either de facto or legally, are going to have to be subject to negotiations. And I think the Ukrainians are going to be very careful about not giving away territory that Russia doesn't currently occupy. And they're going to want probably some kind of referendum on this so that any territorial change that does take place can be affirmed through, you know, a peaceful political process rather than through military conquest. You know, that said, the reality is that the Russians are almost certainly not going to give up territory that they now hold. Ukraine does not have the military ability to take it back from them. And the longer this war goes on, the more territory the Ukrainians are going to lose. So it's very much in Ukraine's interest, I think, to move forward in a peace process that results in a ceasefire and prevents their battlefield situation from getting even worse than it is right now.
Right. Right. And I want to come back to a lot of those topics, including the leverage that each side has and also the question of territorial concessions, potentially even sort of shifting views on those that I think are starting to bubble up. But first, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the narrative that I think is one of the primary narratives that I've seen in mainstream coverage leading up to this summit, which is that Putin is, in some sense, a master manipulator, that he, in a meeting at this level, is, because of perhaps a background in the KGB or because of just long experience as an international negotiator, capable of pulling the wool over the eyes of those that he is talking to. Do you share that assessment? How do you think about that? And maybe it might even be helpful to think about, you know, in the past, I'm sure that you had a role in prepping, you know, fairly high level political leaders for meetings with Russian officials, that how you thought of that when you did it in the past.
Well, what that really is an argument against any kind of diplomatic engagement with Putin and Russia whatsoever. And the people that tend to make that argument are people that don't want to see this war come to a compromise end. They believe either that we need to enable Ukraine to defeat Russia on the battlefield, or we need to create a situation in which Russia is forced to capitulate through a combination of military and political and economic pressure. The problem with that argument is that approach has been tried. It's been tried for many years now and hasn't worked. We don't have the ability to force Russian capitulation, to force Russia to say uncle and agree to terms that are more or less dictated by Ukraine and the West. We're going to have to compromise. So given that, is there a danger of engaging with Putin, a danger that he could deceive us and talk us into accepting terms that aren't in our interest? I think there's actually a very low possibility of that. Now, why? Because the Russians do need a deal. It is not in their interest to create some sort of deception that will come back to haunt them when it is discovered and people say, hey, well, wait a minute. It's not as if the United States is somehow locked into an agreement that it can't get out of because Putin has deceived us and now we're stuck. We're forced to implement it. If the United States looks at this and says, hey, wait a minute, this is not okay. This really crosses some serious red lines for us. We're not going to ratify it. We're not going to agree to it. So that's number one. So the danger that people are pointing to here is not all that great a danger, number one. Right. Number two, why does Putin need a deal? It's true that Russian forces have the advantage on the battlefield, that Ukraine is in fact running out of men. It's running out of the ability to put well-trained and well-equipped forces in the field. And you're seeing the results of that on the battlefield. The Russians are making advances at a faster rate than they have in years. Pokrovsk is likely to fall within days or weeks. And that's a very significant advance. And that will lead to a compounding effect where Ukraine will have increasing difficulties on the battlefield, holding off Russian advances. That is all true. But even if Russia achieves all of the things on territorial conquest that it has laid out as objectives, let's say it takes all four of those regions that it has officially annexed but doesn't yet completely occupy militarily, Russia is still left with a big security problem that can't be fixed by winning the war on the ground in Ukraine. And the biggest part of that is NATO. They will not have solved the problem that NATO forces and NATO enlargement poses to Russia's broader national security. They're facing a situation right now where NATO is twice the size that it was at the end of the Cold War. It had 16 members when the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union broke up. It now has 32 members. It has a longer border with the Russian Federation than any time before in history. And it is about to deploy for the first time since the mid-1980s, intermediate range, highly accurate advanced missiles on German territory that pose a profound threat to Russia's strategic assets and could well be equipped with nuclear warheads. Russia can't do a thing about those issues that really secures Russia against the threats that are posed there. It doesn't have a military large enough to guard that border conventionally against NATO. It's going to have to rely increasingly on nuclear weapons to deal with the size and the technological advantages that NATO poses. And that's not something that the Russians want to have to do. It puts their own security on a hair trigger, meaning, you know, the warning times for attacks coming out of Europe against Russia's strategic facilities, its command and control sites for its nuclear force, are measured in a handful of minutes. That's not a good thing. The only way the Russians can deal with that problem is by dealing with the United States and the West, finding a way to return to the arms control table, put in place conventional theater and strategic arms control measures, confidence and security building measures that diminishes the threat posed to Russia and makes the likelihood of escalation into conflict between Russia and NATO much less than it will otherwise be. And the Russians know that. Now, why are they in the situation they're in? A large part of it is their own doing. They have done things belligerently vis-a-vis their neighbors, vis-a-vis Ukraine with this invasion, that have made the threat with NATO much worse. But all that aside, they need a deal here. Now, geopolitically, I think there are also reasons why Putin would want a better relationship with the West. What has happened is, because Russia essentially has no relationship with Europe anymore, no relationship with the United States to speak of, Russia has become much more dependent on China. China has, as a result of that dependence, a lot of bargaining power, a lot of leverage vis-a-vis Russia, because Russia has no alternatives to China. So that's not an ideal geopolitical situation for the Russians. There's no question that they want to have, you know, good, strong, cooperative relations with China. That's critical to Russia's economy, to its national security. But Russia's ability to maneuver in the world and play an influential role to act as the great power that Putin and almost every other Russian believes Russia ought to be, you need to be able to look both east and west, to have diplomatic relations with the United States and Europe, as well as with China. Then Russia can play a role as a pole in this emerging multipolar world that we're seeing evolve right now. So geopolitically, I think Putin has an incentive to want a better relationship with the West, not necessarily a partnership, not close, warm relations necessarily, but normal relations. One where we're not on the brink of escalating into direct conflict, one in which we have normal diplomatic and economic discourse. I think that's something that is in Russia's interest. I think Putin understands that. And that is a factor here that I think disincentivizes him to try to pull the wool over our eyes and reach some sort of, you know, deceptive deal. He needs something that's more enduring. And it's not because he's a great guy or you should trust him because he has high personal integrity. It's because it's in his interest and Rush's own self-interest for this to work.
Right. Right. And while we're on the topic of Russian interests, I think it's helpful to think, too, there's sort of, I've seen different narratives over the last couple of years about the extent to which Russia is perhaps desperate to reach a deal in order to have some sort of winding back of sanctions. Can you talk a little bit about the extent to which the Russian economy is at this point suffering and whether that is a factor in Putin's decision making?
Well, this issue of the effect of sanctions and how much leverage this provides the United States and Europe in dealing with Russia is really a matter of degree. It's not a question of are they effective or are they not effective. The sanctions are having an effect. There's no question about it. You know, the Russian economy would have different prospects were these sanctions removed. The real question here is, are they onerous enough to compel Russian capitulation? And here, I think the United States has made a fundamental miscalculation, and it happened very early, even before this invasion took place. We looked at this potential invasion of Ukraine, and we thought it was largely an elective for the Russians, a nice to do, something that was an ambition, not an imperative. That's not how the Russians have seen it from the very start. They've looked at this as an existential issue for Russia. The prospect of Ukraine joining NATO or hosting NATO military forces on its territory was one that the Russians thought threatened the very existence of the Russian Federation. That if they were to face that kind of circumstance, you know, Russia could probably not hold together as a federation, probably could not be a great power on the world stage. And for reasons that I think are highly idiosyncratic to Russia, the Russians don't think that they can actually survive as a state if they're not a great power. Mm. Now, so because we thought this was an elective, we thought, well, if we increase the costs of an invasion to Russia, if we impose severe economic sanctions, if we take military measures in aiding the Ukrainians that result in high Russian casualties, if we make Russia a pariah on the international diplomatic stage, these costs would cause Putin to say, well, you know, it's not worth it. The potential advantages that we're pursuing in Ukraine are being outweighed by the costs. Cost-benefit calculation does not go in our favor. We got to find a way out of this. That was the fundamental premise. But that was not at all the way Putin or other Russians looked at this. They saw this as an imperative, a must do. And when a country thinks it's facing an existential threat, it will endure an enormous amount of pain and suffering in order to make sure it survives. And that's the situation that we've been in. Now, that said, would Russia like to see these sanctions lifted? I think on balance, sure. In part because it will help the Russian economy. In part because that kind of discourse with the West will serve as a counterbalance to some degree to China's influence on Russia. It gives Russia options in negotiating terms of trade. If the Europeans are buying Russian gas, for example, the Chinese are much less able to dictate what the price of gas will be that they purchase from the Russians because the Russians have other customers. That only makes sense. So, sure, they'd like to have more normal economic and trade discourse with the West, but it's not so important to them that they are going to give up critical interests in order to secure that end to sanctions. It's a nice to do, they'd like it, but it's not something that's going to really drive their behavior in ending the war in Ukraine.
Right. Right. And I'm curious, I'm sure that people listening to this podcast have probably seen plenty of coverage in American and European media leading into this, so I won't waste too much time discussing that. But I know that you read Russian and you pay attention to Russian media, Russian analysts. What are they saying about this summit? What are their hopes?
Well, I think they're cautiously optimistic. They, I think, are convinced at this point that President Trump is serious about wanting to find an end to this war. And they're convinced that he accepts that Russia has legitimate security interests at stake in all of this. And those are big changes, obviously. I think under the Biden administration, they were not at all convinced, A, that the United States wanted some sort of negotiated end to the conflict. And they were certainly not of the opinion that anybody in the Biden administration or Washington more broadly believed that Russia had any legitimate interest at stake in all of this, that this was, from their point of view, purely a war of imperial conquest, full stop. I think Russian experts, Russian analysts do grasp that Trump has a different perspective on this. Now, where are they concerned? They're concerned that Trump is not going to be able to bring the rest of the Washington foreign policy apparatus along with him on a deal. Putin has talked publicly about this, that he's dealt with a lot of American presidents, and there have been several instances where he thought they had reached understandings only to discover that the deep state yanked the leash and hold things back. And the Russians, I think, are quite acutely sensitive to this, and they're looking for indications that Trump has coattails, so to speak, bureaucratically. Can he bring the deep state along on this? And I think the Russians are still skeptical on this, but they're increasingly optimistic. The second thing they're concerned about is that Trump might lose faith that the Russians actually want a deal. Might not have the patience to see through what are likely to be, long and complicated and difficult negotiations, and will suddenly just say, do this or else. And the or else looks a lot like the way he dealt with Kim Jong-un in North Korea in his first term. And we wind up in a confrontation that the Russians don't want. So that is a concern too. I think the final thing is, it's one thing to deal with Trump in a small circle of negotiators that are handling this issue on behalf of the White House right now. It's another thing to enter into long-term negotiations over strategic arms control, European security measures, theater nuclear forces, conventional arms in Europe, those sorts of things. That is not something that three guys in the White House can do. It requires fleshing out a staff of people that have expertise and experience in these areas that can handle these at a government-to-government negotiation level. And I think the Russians look at the Trump administration and says, they're not ready for that yet. And I think, in fairness, the Russians are right. The Trump administration is still really not staffed out to make rapid progress on all the different areas in bilateral relations, military and security negotiations, in trade talks, the Arctic, counterterrorism, all of these things. The team is not yet staffed yet. And I think the Russians are looking at that and saying, wait a minute. Now, finally, where are the Russian experts concerned? can we bring Ukraine and Europe along with us? That's a factor that's right now, I think, very much in play and very uncertain.
Yeah, I'm curious to ask about, it's good that you brought that up because I wanted to jump into that a little bit. It seems to me as if we're seeing a slight shift in the way that European leaders and even Ukrainian leaders are talking about the conflict. I know that NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte made a comment making it seem as if territorial sort of conversations may be on the table. Even Zelensky himself, in a statement alongside German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, seemed to say that, you know, if a full ceasefire is in place, then territorial conversations can take place. And of course, if those conversations are taking place, then there's an openness to concessions at some level. So do you share that assessment that there's some movement from the Europeans and Ukrainians in recent months?
Well, yeah, there has been some movement. I think Europe, over the course of a few short months, has recognized that simply opposing a settlement in Ukraine is not viable under the circumstances that they face with the Trump administration. Early on, I think Trump's insistence on an immediate unconditional ceasefire played into European hands because, you know, a lot of Europeans are not yet ready to see a deal. They worry about the prospect of negotiating with Russia over Europe's security architecture. They worry about Russia having a voice in European security matters, which is part of what this conflict is all about. You know, they'd prefer that the war continue rather than agreeing to a settlement that they think would hurt their own interests. They also worry about the United States leaving Europe altogether. And they have seen this war in Ukraine as one way of ensuring that the United States remains an active player in European security matters. Now, that said, they have come around and to a great degree. They are now, you know, recognizing that there needs to be a settlement. They're continuing to insist on an unconditional ceasefire as step number one, in part because they know the Russians won't accept that. And that is an artful way of saying, you know, see, we're calling for peace and the Russians won't agree. Now, what the Russians are saying is, sure, we'll talk about a ceasefire once we have nailed down some critical things that affect Russia's own security. And I expect what's going to happen in Alaska is that we will reach some agreements, some understandings on those core issues. And that in turn will enable negotiations on putting a ceasefire in place. And my guess is that the Europeans won't be able to oppose that, quite honestly. At that point, they would be put in a position where they either get on the train, which is moving, or they get left at the station and they don't have a voice in any of all this. And I think they will choose to get on the train as it moves toward peace. Right. And my guess is that the Ukrainians will too, because they don't really have much of a choice. They're losing on the battlefield. The more time that goes by, the worse their position on the battlefield is, number one. Number two, they realize that they can't sustain this war without American help. Not just military aid, but much more important intelligence data, intelligence aid, without which the Ukrainians can't operate the high-precision weaponry that we've provided. It just won't work without that intelligence data. And they're largely blind to what the Russians are throwing at them on the ground and by, you know, missile and air attacks. So the Ukrainians won't be in much of a position to say, yeah, no, we're just going to fight this on our own and the Europeans are going to support us. That's a losing hand. So the question of territory is one that I think the Trump administration is simply going to defuse. The big concern that both Ukraine and Europe have had on this is that Trump and Putin will cut some sort of territorial deal over their heads. know, they'll get out a map in Alaska and start saying, you know, here's Russian territory, here's Ukrainian territory, and then present that to Europe and Ukraine as a fait accompli. And I highly doubt that's going to happen. I think Trump has already indicated that he has no intention of doing that. It's not viable. It's a formula for failure in this. I think the presidents are going to agree on some principles, and then it's going to be up to Ukraine and Russia bilaterally to work out this question of territory. And that's going to take a long time, but I don't think any kind of deal is going to be cut over the Ukrainians' heads.
Right. And on this question of sequencing, you brought up that, you know, sort of it's in the Europeans' interest to call for a full ceasefire immediately before negotiations, because that's almost saying something that Russia won't do. You mentioned as one reason Russia won't do that is that it wants to address these broader security issues. So can we dig into that a little bit more? It's that Russia basically needs to have that battlefield leverage continuing in order to feel as if it is making a fair deal. Like, where, how exactly do you think they're thinking through the problem?
Well, so
this was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.